Let's pray. Father, we're thankful for the fact that you give your Spirit to those who ask you, and we're in need of that Spirit to both absorb the material, properly deliver it, and deliver it clearly, and also to profit by it and to learn those lessons and to see Christ working in those ways that we ought to see him working in the early church. And so we ask for your help. In Jesus' name, amen. We have come to part two. The expansion of the early church is the general subject, and section one of that is its classical setting. That is to say, its setting in the classical world, the world of Greece and Rome, into which it was born. And we need to look at five issues here, and under section one, the Christian problem, social milieu, religious trends, philosophical movements, moral climate. All right? And so Christian problem, first of all. While Christianity was derived from Judaism, it was called to bring the gospel to the world. And for the early generations of Christians, that world was equivalent to the Hellenistic civilization dominated by the Roman Empire. A decree went out from Caesar Augustus that a census be taken of all the inhabited earth. And if I remember correctly, the New English translation of that says something like the whole Roman Empire, which is what is really meant. Bringing the gospel to this world was the challenge of the early church. It was a world dominated by millennia, by a way of thought and life utterly alien to the truth as it had to be taught the truth of God. So the dangers were really twofold: to hinder the gospel by insisting on the acceptance with it of outmoded Jewish trappings. The only small place in the world where the truth of God had been known was that little place inhabited by the Jews in Palestine and some other scattered synagogues. And so there was the danger that Old Testament Jewish trappings would be insisted on, and this was the tendency illustrated in the New Testament by the Judaizers, and later on by people called the Jews called the Ebionites, who were Jewish Christians in quotes. And the other danger was to so adapt the gospel to pagan ways of thought that its distinctive message was lost. Terminology which might be meaningful and interesting to the Greeks and Romans had to be used, but that terminology could not be allowed to retain its pagan definitions. And so you find words like mysterion, mystery, logos, word, Lord, kurios, that are familiar to Greek ears, well known in the Hellenistic world, but these words must be allowed to draw their specific content from the Old Testament background, New Testament context. And, of course, it's much debated how well the early church avoided this problem. A liberal historian like Harnack claims the Nicene and Chalcedonian creeds were seriously distorted by Greek pagan thought, and many have thought that some remnants of Greek philosophy can be traced in those creeds, or at least in early Christianity. In all eras, the church faces a similar challenge. It must present the gospel in terms that can be understood, but not relativize the gospel by too much accommodation to human culture. Social milieu in a second place. The origins of the social milieu into which Christianity was born were twofold. They grew out of the Alexandrian conquest in the 4th century BC of pretty much the known world. And these Alexandrian conquest, the Macedonian Empire, had united most of the known world in a common language and culture, the Greek language and the Hellenistic culture. Hellenistic, by the way, is and refers to a combination of Hellenic and then Middle Eastern culture. But the second thing which had united the world in a common social milieu into which Christianity was born was the Roman conquest, which had united most of the known world under a single law and government, the Roman law. And the Roman government, that was the second element of this milieu. What were its characteristics? Well, the characteristics of the resultant social milieu were significant advantages for the mission of the early church. There is, first of all, de facto pluralism. De facto pluralism. This is the Latin phrase, which is usually contrasted with this phrase, de jure. When I say that there was a pluralism, I am saying that there, in fact, was in society the acceptance of many different religions. There was a kind of pluralistic context. However, that context was not the assumed norm of society. It was only de facto, as a matter of fact, and not de jure, a matter of law, because as a matter of law, all pre-Christian societies were sacral in character. And this is something that's really hard for 21st century Americans to realize. To realize that the separation of church and state is something the world has known only for the last 3 to 4 centuries in any legal kind of formal way. Sacral is a word that means as of or for religious rites. Verdine says, quote, in a sacral society there is unanimity on the religious plane. What Cicero said of the Rome of his day is true of all sacral societies, of all pre-Christian societies. Every commonwealth has its religion, and we have ours. This is a sacral assumption that you need one religion for one country, and one country must have one religion, and things can't work culturally any other way. And so in such a society, the separation of church and state's unthinkable and intolerable, not just irrational, but absolutely, in a sense, culturally immoral. To differ religiously in such a society, that is to say a sacral society, meant persecution, exile, or death, because more than one religion could not be tolerated in the society. But the Roman Empire exhibited what I've called a de facto pluralism. Though most people still thought in sacral terms, as a matter of fact, the Roman Empire was far from that ideal. Roman armies had brought many nations and thus many religions into one empire. The Romans, however, if they were anything, were smart politicians, and they knew that enforcing the Roman gods on all the empire and eliminating the national gods and religions would spell political troubles even multiplied Roman legions could not solve. Thus, many religions came to coexist in the empire. There was a de facto religious pluralism. Now, there's a qualification to this. Early in the empire, emperor worship began, and soon it took on a more official status, and this would spell major problems for the church. Offering incense or sacrifice to Caesar became a state religion, signifying political loyalty. Now, even this was not strictly enforced early on, or even as persecution grew. An uneasy truce with the Jews allowed them to pray and sacrifice for the emperor rather than to him. And though this was threatened by the egotism of the emperor known as commonly as Caligula, whose full name was Gaius Caligula in 40 AD. He almost blew up the Jewish war 25 years prior to when it actually happened by threatening to bring, I think, the Roman legions' graven images, the eagle on the top of the banners, into the temple. But that was saved at the last minute. And there was a truce that held between Rome and the Jews until 66 A.D. Further, as already implied, other religions were not forbidden as long as Caesar worship was carried on. The result was that while sacralism was not dead, in many cases, in most places, it was an unattainable, unenforceable ideal. Thus, Providence had supplied a political situation in which the modicum of freedom needed to preach the gospel was present. If persecution came in one city, in the words of the New Testament, there was at least a possibility of fleeing to the next. And so as with the confusion of tongues at Babel and the removal of Abraham from Ur of the Chaldees to the melting pot of the promised land, so now God had provided the pluralistic society necessary for the spread of the gospel, for the planting of the gospel seed. The concrete of sacralism had been smashed small enough that the gospel seed might be planted. But we come to a second point, and that's the Roman peace. The Roman peace. The Roman Empire was at its pinnacle from the reign of Augustus, the first emperor. Of course, Rome was officially a republic prior to that, not an empire. The first emperor was Augustus Caesar, of course, before him, transitionally Julius. But Augustus, from 27 BC to the end of the reign of Marcus Aurelius, AD 180, is known as the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. Roman rule and law brought a stability, rough justice, protection, and prosperity unparalleled in previous history. Paul, enjoying the freedom and immunities of Roman citizenship, traveled in relative security. And so in 1 Timothy 2, 1 and 2, he urged Christians to pray for their Roman rulers, that this advantageous context for the gospel mission might continue. And that advantageous context was due in no small part to the Pax Romana. There was a common language, and this was, of course, very advantageous. The common language was not Latin. It was Greek. The Greek language is spoken everywhere as a second language, at least. It was a copious, expressive language with a rich cultural, intellectual history, and a language capable of making clear distinctions. And, of course, our New Testaments were originally written in Koine, that is to say, common Greek. And then the Roman peace had also expedited land travel. Roman roads are famous, still some places to be seen in Europe. And also Roman fleets swept the Mediterranean of pirates, making sea travel more secure. No, you didn't have to wait for pirates till pirates of the Caribbean. There were pirates of the Mediterranean before there were pirates of the Caribbean, just so you know. And the victories of Pompey in 67 BC over the Cilician pirates were significant in this regard. So our conclusion must be that of the New Testament, Mark 13:10, the gospel must first be preached to all the nations, and it is this divine must which can be discerned in the presence of all these conditions which furthered the gospel. The third thing that we need to consider under this head is the religious trends. The religious trends. Quoting Kelly, the world in which the church made triumphant is sometimes painful headway was hungry for religion. Surviving monuments of every kind testify to the desperate longing felt by all classes for assurance against death and fate, redemption from evil, spiritual cleansing, union with God. In this religion-hungry world, several trends may be spotted. The first is, at the time of the advent of Christianity, the decline of classicism. By classicism, the worship of the ancient Greco-Roman pantheons is meant. F.F. Bruce says the old classical religions were bankrupt. Now, you know what we're talking about here, where there were these, made famous by modern movies and comic books and everything else, but there were these pantheons from Rome and then from Greece, both a Latin pantheon and a Greek pantheon, that kind of paralleled one another and really got merged. The Latin pantheon, the supreme god was Jupiter. The supreme god parallel to him in the Greek pantheon was Zeus. And down you went with parallel gods and these great pantheons of these polytheistic religions. Well, they were bankrupt. Periodic attempts by Roman emperors, all the way from Augustus to Julian, were to reinvigorate these cults could only postpone their demise. It was neither credible nor satisfying to the population of the empire. And into this vacuum had come the influx of Oriental mystery religions. Eastern cults proved more satisfying to the masses and moved into the religious vacuum created by the demise of classicism. The popularity of such cults may be attributed to an assurance of immortality. They promise their adherents immortality. That is to say, life after death of some kind. They purported to deliver their devotees from the terror of the unknown universe, and because they gave them an understanding, a knowledge of the unknown universe, of the great beings that populated it, and also to the fact that they gave their adherents a certain camaraderie with their co-religionist. These religions often centered upon a dying and rising God and whose death and resurrection, think of the fall and the spring, in whose death and resurrection the initiates came to share through secret ceremonies. By such ceremonies, knowledge of the mysteries was gained. Sometimes these mysteries were and ceremonies were quite dramatic. The initiation was intended to give the experience of a new birth. One vegetarian cult had a meal of raw meat as part of its initiation. You can imagine, after that, you'd never want to eat meat again in your life. And then there was this wonderful rite. In the rites of Cybele and Attis, the initiate underwent a kind of baptism in the blood of a bull or a ram which was slain above, and as a result, he felt himself reborn forever. Well, you'd certainly feel something after that, wouldn't you? There was a grate, and the initiate was led under the grate, and they'd slaughter the bull, cut the neck of the bull, and the blood would gush down and cover the initiate. And certainly that would have been a great experience. You would have been different after that forever. Whether you were reborn or not is, of course, another question. Now, these cults were multitudinous. Astarte, Baal, Cybele, Adonis, and many others were worshipped. The most popular seemed to have been the cults of Isis and Mithra. Isis was a female deity of Egypt with varied abilities. The nature of her worship is well enough indicated by the comment that Egyptian lord knew her as a wife, a mother, and a whore. Women were her most numerous devotees. Mithra, on the other hand, was a sun god, a male deity, and the soldier's god. We'll come to this. Constantine and most of his army, before he became Christian, were worshippers of Mithra, the sun god. And by then, this sun god worship had evolved into what can be called a solar monotheism. The sun was the great and single god. And for a lot of people, it was a stepping stone into Christianity, actually, and for some obvious symbolic reasons, probably. Anyway, the syncretism. Syncretism, what is that? Well, syncretism is the combination of differing beliefs in religion, according to Webster. Kelly says syncretism was the product of this mutual jostling of religions. The gods of one country were identified with those of another. You had that most basically in the fusing of the Latin and Greek pantheons. The gods of one country were identified with those of another, and the various cults fused with and borrowed from each other indiscriminately. Thus, while there was little organizational unity among the same cult throughout the empire, there was a general homogeneity and syncretism among all the cults of polytheism. You could actually go worship Mithra on Sunday and then Isis on Monday and go to one of the other cults on Tuesday if you like, because they didn't care. You could be a member of them all. It was true of all these religions. They were syncretistic, except two. Jews wouldn't let you go worship Mithra on Sunday after going to the synagogue. If you did that, you were in trouble in the synagogue, and Christians wouldn't let you do that either. They were both exclusivistic. Sinigan and Boke say in their History of the Classical World, two religions, Judaism and Christianity, differed from their pagan counterparts in their dogmatism. Their claims were exclusivistic, contrasting them dramatically with the syncretism and inclusivism of the other religions, which allowed one person to be a devotee of several cults or to syncretistically identify different cults. Just putting them together in a way not dissimilar to the way 21st century Americans like to combine elements of different religions to make up their own. Well, a fourth characteristic of this religious context was belief in personal immortality. Now, there were forms of Greek philosophy that were hostile to personal immortality, as we're going to see even this lecture or the next. Epicureanism was hostile to the notion of personal immortality. Yet, belief in the immortality of the soul was nonetheless general, and Epicureans were never more than a philosophical elite, it seems. This general belief may have owed in part to Greek philosophy, especially Pythagoras, and following him, Plato. Plato taught reincarnation, or what is also called the transmigration of souls. And with this carried with it the idea of future judgment for good or ill, at least if not quite the same as karma, well, at least something like it. It did generally entail, however, this personal immortality, the resurrection of the body. It's clear from the New Testament, Acts 17, 32, Paul's comment in Acts 26, 8, why is it accounted incredible among you people if God should raise the dead? That was said to the elite leaders of the provinces around Palestine. In Acts 26, 8, and 1 Corinthians 15 also make it evident. The Christian doctrine of the resurrection of the body did not meet with a positive reception from the Greeks, which is why in opposition to that, Christians in the Apostles' Creed and ever after emphasized the resurrection of the flesh in opposition to the common idea of Greek religion, that the flesh and the body were simply evil things to be gotten rid of as fast as possible. Well, that brings us to another feature of this religious climate, and that is an attraction to monotheism. This growing attraction to monotheism was a result of many different factors. While it was not theistic in a Christian sense, Greek philosophy in different ways tended to leave what I guess we can best call a monotheistic impression. Aristotelianism began with its unmoved mover, who was not necessarily God, but was easily enough identified as one by popular thought. Stoicism, with its pantheism and its idea of the world soul, also tended in that direction, even though it was really pantheistic rather than theistic, or at least panentheistic rather than theistic. And Neoplatonism's emphasis on the one at the pinnacle of being also was something that made popular thought trend in a monotheistic direction. Two, the syncretism already mentioned, with this amalgamation of different gods, tended, I think, toward a kind of monotheism. Three, the Mithra cult, with its worship of Deus Invictus Sol Mithra, the unconquered god, son of the sun, Mithra. Especially in its later phases became a kind of solar monotheism. Its devotees were influenced by Neoplatonism. Many of these identified as one with their solo monotheism, the cults of Zeus, Apollo, Mithra, and Helios. And four, of course, we must not forget that Judaism had spread far and wide by persecution and other means, and so the far-flung synagogues of Judaism also exercised an influence for monotheism, though the New Testament is witness enough to the many God-fearers, Gentiles, who had somehow, in some fashion, at some level, adopted Judaism and its worship of one God as their own. Okay, now, we come after those first three Roman numerals to Roman numeral 4. And here's where I was facing a decision. It'd be really nice and neat just to cut it off right here, but that's a 25-minute lecture. So I'm going to go on and go through at least Epicureanism before we come to the end of this lecture, and that at least provide a little bit more evenness for the time frames. Roman numeral 4, then, the philosophical movements. The history of Greek philosophy, and this is something that would make a wonderful quiz question, or test question, can be divided into three fairly well-marked epochs. You may think of the pre-Socratic era, 585 to 399 BC, the era of Plato and Aristotle, 385 to 323, kind of the pinnacle of Greek philosophy, at least the birth of it as we know it today. And then the Hellenistic Age, 300 BC to AD 529. 529, I better not guess, but it was about then, I think, that the last Greek philosophical school was closed, actually. Now, it is, of course, the so-called Hellenistic Age which interests us, because that's the age into which Christianity was born. Gordon H. Clark has helpfully summarized these different eras. If the pre-Socratic era is characterized as scientific, and if Plato and Aristotle are predominantly, though not exclusively, epistemological, the chief interest among the philosophers of the Hellenistic Age is ethical. So he's saying that those in the pre-Socratic era were interested in understanding the world. Plato and Aristotle were interested in understanding the roots of human knowledge, how we know. That's what epistemology studies, the study of knowing or of knowledge. And then the philosophers of the Hellenistic Age were ethical, which is interesting because it lies very close, does the ethical idea, to the religious. At any rate, in the Hellenistic Age, three major philosophies are of concern to us: Epicureanism, Platonism, and Stoicism. Now, Epicureanism is widely misunderstood, and I'll come to it in a second. Epicureanism and Stoicism arose during the Hellenistic Age, while Platonism, though arising earlier, continued into the Hellenistic Age. Three periods in the history of Platonism may also be distinguished. You know, there is the original Platonism, Plato himself, middle Platonism. This is identified with Philo, who lived and wrote around 50 BC. And then Neoplatonism, which arose in the 3rd century AD. And it's interesting that these three eras of Platonism are identified with three guys that whose names start with P: Plato, Philo, and the author of Neoplatonism, Plotinus. Okay, so you can just think of Plato, Philo, and Plotinus for Platonism, Middle Platonism, Neoplatonism. Any rate, Epicureanism, Stoicism, and Neoplatonism were characterized by a common ethical religious interest. And so, first of all, Epicureanism. Its founder, Epicurus, lived from 341 to 270 BC. If I remember correctly, that name, at least the name of the philosophical school that he represented, was actually used in Acts 17, isn't it? I was reminding myself here because I'm kind of curious. Oh, yes. Epicureon. All right. Sounds like the English, doesn't it? I saw it someplace, his name spelled Epicurus or something like this. But at any rate, first thing you have to understand about Epicureanism is that it had a very anti-religious motivation. So it was religious by contradiction. As has been said, the ethical religious interest is central in Epicureanism, basically because it wanted to get rid of religion because its great aim was peace of mind, autarkia, or to put that in a different form, undisturbedness. Philotimus, or Philodemus, or however you say that, it epitomizes this in his lines. This is Epicureanism. There is nothing to fear in God. There is nothing to be alarmed of in death. Good is easily obtained. Evil is easily endured. That philosophy was intended to help you achieve peace of mind. Now, the archenemy of such an ideal is, of course, religion. Quote, religion for an Epicurean consists mainly in the belief that gods reward and punish, especially punish mankind. Fear of punishment in a future life makes the present life unbearable. And so, of course, how could you have peace of mind if you were religious? You couldn't. You never quite knew what God was going to do you next for all your bad deeds. And so you have an anti-religious motivation. Then you have what we can only call atomistic physics. With this anti-religious ideal governing his thought, Epicurus adapted the atomic theory of Democritus to his need. Democritus is the one that came up with the idea of the atom, the smallest conceivable particle, which we know now isn't the smallest conceivable particle, but which they thought was in the Greek world. Now, this theory speculated that the ultimate principles of the universe were atoms endlessly falling in an infinite void. So this everything that happens is a result of these atoms colliding with each other. Now, to this theory, so Charlottestadt, for instance, is only a collection of atoms that have collided with each other. And if you think about it, that makes a little sense, doesn't it? Anyway, to this theory, Epicurus added his doctrine of the swerve. And this, of course, is best illustrated by Irene Longtime, but we'll leave that aside. These atoms imperceptibly and inexplicably deviate from their paths. Well, I told you, causing collisions and making all things. And this inexplicable swerve is the basis for avoiding determinism and the basis for free will. There's these random swerves, so there's no determinism because you don't know where Irene will swerve next. If the world were mechanical, there could be no human freedom. And so Epicurus advocates what we might call a materialistic indeterminism. Say that three times fast. Thirdly, its ethical character. This materialism allows Epicurus to deny any personal immortality and thus defeat his archenemy religion and attain his ideal of peace of mind. Because when you die, the atoms just fall apart and everything is just as it was. And there is no hereafter and therefore no judgment in the hereafter. So if there's no personality and personal immortality, there's no divine judgment to disturb our peace of mind. Now this leads us to discuss Epicurus' assertion that the purpose of life was the enjoyment of pleasure, which has often been corrupted by the misuse of his philosophy. This was the intrinsic value on which his ethics were based, the enjoyment of pleasure, hedonism. But a peculiar type of hedonism, not hedonism as you would expect. Of course, the popular meaning of Epicureanism equates this kind of enjoyment of pleasure with sensual libertinism. Even very early, many thought this to be his meaning in rabbinic Hebrew and Aramaic, and Epicurus was an irreverent heretic or libertine. In reality, Epicurus rejected such an idea. Pleasure is undisturbedness, is the absence of pain and freedom from care. He advocated a comparatively high ethic. Sensuality doesn't produce atarachia. In fact, he would have agreed with the parody, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we shall have gout, cirrhosis of the liver, and delirium tremens. So essentialism was no way to have peace of mind. Rather, the opposite. A retired philosophical life out in some estate someplace where you stayed out of trouble and you stayed out of society and you minded your own business and you kind of spent the days in philosophical, contemplation with a light meal at the end of it, that was the way to live. Practical acceptance. Epicureanism had ceased to be a meaningful influence by the time of the early empire. Of course, we know from the New Testament there are still some of them around. While certain of the patrician class practiced its ideals, because you had to have a country estate to retire to practice this, it was rejected by the vast majority of the Romans and their subjects. And there are reasons for this, at least three of them. First of all, Epicureanism was a rigid, inflexible system. His Epicurus' last words were, remember the dogmas. So his disciples did that and preserved his teaching without modification and did not therefore have the flexibility to adapt like competing philosophical systems. The second reason why it was rejected is that it really failed to bring men true happiness. It might have been enough for Epicurus to have simply undisturbedness, without personal immortality. But that failed to satisfy most people's longings. And see, and perhaps most importantly, Epicureanism did not provide the kind of political and social philosophy adapted to the needs of the Roman Empire. The cares of a political and a family life, the, you know, the large Roman families and estates and all the things you had to do to make it politically and to run an empire. Well, all of those kind of things were inconsistent with the ideal of undisturbedness. The last thing you want to be doing, if you want undisturbedness, is trying to run a family or an empire. And so, a lot of Romans didn't think it was very politically correct to be an Epicurean. Also, its atomism did not provide a sound philosophical basis, because it basically said the universe was ultimately just random atoms, many random atoms, with really no final unifying factor. But that's contrary to the empire. The empire has got to be the unifying factor in the world. That's what the Roman Empire is supposed to be. And how does, you know, this kind of atomistic physics fit with that? It doesn't. Well, we'll come back to those political priorities in a minute, but Platonism is the second thing we need to come to. But there, if I launch, we have a considerable amount of things to say, so I'm going to stop here with the first lecture, and we'll come to Platonism and Stoicism in the second lecture. All right, questions, ladies and gentlemen? Eric looks like he has a question on his face.
Do you, and I know you mean this is probably readily available on many online sources, but do you have any of this, the history that we talked about so far, kind of mapped out on a page or two where we can look at it and say, okay.
The history of the what?
This history with all of these people that we're talking about kind of mapped out in a timeline or...
I'm not sure quite what you're asking for, Eric. You mean beyond the kind of outline I've given you?
I'm thinking more of just kind of at a glance, you know.
Like the conquest of the Roman Empire?
Maybe. That
yeah. Next week, I'm going to give you a map of the Roman Empire at the time during the Pax Romana, and we'll also give you a graph with regard to the waxing and waning of the persecution of the church. But the actual conquest of the empire, I'm not sure that's really what you want, but and the spread of the empire, I don't have something on that, but you can find something pretty easily online, I think, if you look for it. Any other questions? Yes, Andrew.
I'm trying to think about like Epicureanism and how, to me, it sounds fairly religious in nature, at least with a broad definition of religion as being a system of beliefs with a certain practice. Religion here, and speaking of Epicureanism, you know, being opposed to religion, is religion being equated with, like, theism?
So, yeah, of course, that's one of the major questions that you have to discuss in any, well, say, introduction to religion course, is what is religion? How does it to be defined? And Epicureanism, in some sense, would fit some of the academic definitions of religion. That is to say, the one I would always teach and then critique had to do with understanding someone's what has unrestricted value for someone and what rights, beliefs, and ethics go along with that. And Epicureanism would fit that general academic idea of religion because it has an unrestricted value, and that unrestricted value is undisturbedness, I guess. But it's anti-religious in the sense that most religions include the idea of God and judgment and afterlife, and it was irreligious or anti-religious in the sense that it opposed all those things. So it depends, it really does depend on how you define religion, and whether you want to accept some of the academic definitions of religion, where you can have religion without God, in fact, a religion without anybody but yourself, really. Am I answering your question? Okay. Okay. Let's take a little break.